Hello and welcome to The World This Week with me, Gavin Lee. It's been a weird week in international politics. Another one, an upside down, black is white, Lewis Carroll, logic kind of week. 3 years after ending all official communications with Moscow, the US government suddenly back in Russia's orbit. The two nuclear powers sitting down in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday, finding a path to ending the Ukraine war. And more besides, the talks were no longer about how to deal with the aggressor in the conflict, but how to normalise relations and make Russia a potential partner for future energy deals. So what of Ukraine? Left out of talks, its president picking up the scraps of detail via the press, he said. His biggest ally, the US, now a big problem. Vladimir Zelensky suggesting President Trump was living in Putin's disinformation space. Trump's defense was attack, accusing Zelensky of being a dictator. Moscow holds the cards in the conflict, said Trump. But does Moscow have the president's ear?
Dictator without elections. Zelensky better move fast or he's not going to have a country left. Got to move fast because that war is going in the wrong direction. In the meantime, we're successfully negotiating an end to the war with Russia.
It's been a week where Europe was forced to rapidly rethink its own defences and consider how to remain a relevant voice in Ukraine after also being sidelined.
Which could include the creation
talks.
Of a European...
Emergency meetings scrambled in Paris. Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer called it a once-in-a-generation moment for national security and offered to send British peacekeeping troops to Ukraine in the future. Notably, no room, though, for Hungary or Slovakia, their leaders on friendly terms with President Putin. The Slovak Prime Minister, Robert Fico, said Europe should stop crying with unnecessary nervousness, referencing the shock caused by the US Vice President's recent blunt critique of Europe, which had the head of the Munich Security Conference in tears on Monday.
Let me conclude, and this becomes difficult.
This week's also seen the final TV debate of the German election campaign. The Conservative opposition leader Friedrich Merz is odds-on favourite to be the next Chancellor, a helicopter-flying multi-millionaire, long-time bitter rival of former Chancellor Angela Merkel. But analysts say he is capable of saying the wrong thing at the wrong time and has had to avoid conversationally slipping on a banana skin to win. Meanwhile, current Chancellor Olaf Scholz still thinks he can triumph, even if others have written him off. And there's much focus, too, on the continuing rise of the far-right AfD, expected to double their vote. And having notable support from US Veep, J.D. Vance, Elon Musk and his ex-algorithm too, migration and economy, key voter issues, with Europe's biggest economy sliding closer towards recession. We're going to examine the key issues and profile the contenders.
I think it's important that we understand that Germany is a very strong democracy. And as a strong democracy, we are absolutely clear that the extreme right should be out of political control and out of political decision-making processes, and that there will be no cooperation with them. And we really reject any idea.
Well, alongside me on the panel this week, we go to Chicago first and to Yaroslav Trofimov, chief foreign affairs correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and author of recently published No Country for Love. It is fantastic to have you with us, Yaroslav. First of all, tell us about your novel. It's been described as a historical reflection and a love letter to Ukraine.
Thank you so much. Great to be in the show. Well, the novel is really a story of my family, a story of my grandmother in a fictional form, but it's also a history of Ukraine. It's a history of so many other families that have survived through what perhaps, you know, the deadliest period in European history, the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. It's a time when Ukraine really lost about 15 million people, you know, 4 million people at least, in the artificial famine that Moscow had orchestrated to subdue the Ukrainian countryside, the Holodomor, then the Holocaust, World War II, and then the insurgency that followed suit in Ukraine as the rest of Europe was rebuilding after 1945. And, you know, the relevance of all this is that this is a history that explains Ukraine's resilience today, because everyone in Ukraine today descends from people who survived that grand era of history, who had to make all those painful compromises. And the reason why for 3 years now Ukrainians have been sacrificing so much in the battlefield and refusing to surrender is because they know in their bones that surrender is going to bring more death and more destruction in the long term than continuing to fight. And, you know, we're seeing this on the Russian side. You know, every time Russian troops occupy a Ukrainian town or Ukrainian village, one of the first things they do is to bulldoze or demolish the monuments to the famine that had been engineered by the Russian state, by the Soviet state back in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the logic is Ukrainians say never again, and the Russians say, well, no, it never happened, and we can repeat.
It's going to be great to hear your context and analysis tonight, Yaroslav, somebody who's lived the story as well growing up in Kyiv. Great to have you on the programme. Thank you. Let's go to Berlin. Let's bring in Tom Nuttall, Berlin Bureau Chief for The Economist, formerly Brussels Bureau Chief as well. Tom, it is great to have you with us too this evening. You've been talking this week about the term Grokko Redux. Now, for the dummy's guide to the German elections, this could be the likely result of the election this weekend. What is it?
Grokko Redux means a return of what Germans call the Grand Coalition, which is a government comprising the centre-right Christian Democrats along with the Social Democrats. This was the government formation that was favoured by Angela Merkel for most of her time in office. And it's one possible outcome of the election on Sunday. One is very clear that the Christian Democrats led by Friedrich Merz are going to win. There would have to be an unprecedented polling mistake for the CDU not to come first. The hard right alternative for Germany, the AfD, are also going to have their best ever result. But after that, it all gets a little bit murky. It's complicated. Germany's electoral rules mean that there's big questions over how many parties make it into parliament, which in turn has consequences for coalition formation. So although why I think the winner is not in doubt, there are many questions about what sort of government would emerge from this election.
Very interesting, Tom. We're going to get into the colour coordination of the elections as well as we talk about Germany. And for anybody who's watching this, who just learnt a new word from you, they can go into a cafe or a pub this weekend. If they're asked about what they think the result would be, they think, well, I think it's going to be Grokko Redux. And it sounds like you know what you're saying. Thank you, Tom. Let's also turn to the studio, bring in the acclaimed American author, journalist, war correspondent, friend of the programme too, Janine Giovanni.
Hello.
Brilliant to have you with us, Janine. A career spanning three decades, author of 9 books, recently released The Morning They Came For Us, Dispatches from Syria. You're also the founder of The Reckoning Project as well, training journalists to collect legally admissible testimonies to build robust testimonies for international tribunals. Which strikes me, you've got the most powerful man in the world now questioning the legitimacy of the ICC. We are an unprecedented times trying to report human rights abuses.
Yeah, absolutely. I've come from Munich last weekend where the Reckoning Project hosted a roundtable on the violation of international law during wartime. And I think one of the most striking things for me to come away with is that we are living in a time of immense impunity. Russian crimes in Ukraine, Benjamin Netanyahu's crimes in Gaza, unprecedented, which he still, even though there's an arrest warrant for him at the ICC, goes to Washington and is fed it by congressmen and senators. So, I mean, those of us in the human rights world have to fight more than ever. And we saw Christoph Heusgen, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, an extraordinary diplomat who prior to this was at the UN and worked very hard to bring Syrian war crimes to light, burst into tears. And that really was frustration, but it was also the reversal of the European values that we've had since the end of World War II, of basically, you know, recalibrating the world and rules-based order to a new Trumpian, possibly ARD world in Germany, a world where Putin is now a negotiator rather than President Zelensky. So for those of us trying to unpack and decode all of this, it's been really a week of shock and reeling and a reversal on rules-based order.
You talk about Benjamin Netanyahu facing those allegations, which he has said he calls nonsense, and he continues to deny. But nonetheless, you know, the whole legitimacy of it being questioned by Donald Trump, great to have you with us, Janine. I want to also talk about another colleague who is a friend of the programme, Mark Burley, a Associated Foreign Press, France Press, I should
Agence
say.
France Presse.
Agence France Press. I nearly called you AP rather than AFP.
It wouldn't be the first time.
Let me reel through your list. Formerly in Brussels, London, Australia, Bureau Chief in Central America, Deputy Bureau Chief in Tehran as well. Thank you for joining us.
Left out Brazil.
No, always one. I want to get your perspective tonight. I also notice you're off X, so your journalistic social media habits have changed. Why? Where are you now?
I don't think I'm the only one. I'm not off. I've kept my account, I think.
You're on pause.
I don't contribute to it anymore. I used to be very active. I mean, I don't know if anybody remembers the TweetDeck days. That's where I was definitely there.
All on your big screen, right?
I just had everything.
Like the Matrix.
You just have one screen. We have four screens. So, you know, it's like... but no, I don't contribute. I've taken a step back from social media, I must say. It's probably better for sanity in some ways, but I think it also helps with journalism to keep dispassionate views, and a lot of, particularly on X, I'm finding a lot of it's emotionally driven, which doesn't really help the profession that much. There's less information there.
I think even Janine, I've seen you tweeting that you're slowly going to another side.
I think you're right, Mark. I mean, I find the emotional and the algorithms seem to target exactly the point of your neurotic break. And I just think it's a time waster. I mean, the time that you spent reading it, and a lot of it now, and with X not being vetted at all, you know, you don't know what's propaganda, what's not. I spent enough time trying to weed through Russian propaganda or IDF propaganda, and it just, I think... X is a, you know, I think people are going to Blue Sky, but I think we'll find similar problems there as
like
well.
People, I see a lot of journalists and academics there, but it's still not broad enough for me to get a cross-sectional view of topics. But we're not here to talk about social media.
Those hazy days, the rose-tinted days of when we could all use sources from these different sites. Oh, they've changed. Well, let's start. 10 o'clock, Monday morning, Saudi capital, Riyadh. And the golden chandeliers, Russian and American officials sit across a table. A spectacle that until recently was unthinkable. On one side, US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, two key White House advisers to Donald Trump, and on the other, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, a key Kremlin aide as well to Vladimir Putin. Groundwork lay at getting a path towards peace, is what the Americans called it. Cameras briefly allowed in, recording this moment, and then the talks began, lasting 4.5 hours. Russia talked about the priority to normalize relations. By the end of it, Marco Rubio, U.S. Secretary of State, echoed the same sentiment.
Beginning to engage in identifying the extraordinary opportunities that exist should this conflict come to an acceptable end, the credible opportunities that exist to partner with the Russians geopolitically on issues of common interest and, frankly, economically on issues that hopefully will be good for the world and will also improve our relations in the long term between these two important countries.
And this was the verdict of Russia's longtime foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov.
The conversation was, I believe, very useful. We did not just listen, but we heard each other. And I have reason to believe that the American side has become more aware of our position.
President Zelensky not invited to the talks and cuts a solemn figure as he instead went to another NATO state, Turkey, who offered warmer words and support for territorial integrity of his country. That was from President Erdogan. Meanwhile, at Mar-a-Lago, with rhetoric that could have been copied and pasted from the Kremlin, President Trump tells reporters Ukraine started the war. And so began a war of words, Volodymyr Zelensky suggesting his key ally is living in a Russian-made disinformation space. Trump doubles down, calling Zelensky a dictator, falsely stating his popularity is low. Low as 4%, he said. He needs to call elections, and Russia holds the cards because of the territory it's already taken. The White House National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, stepped in. Tone it down, he told Kyiv.
Why we're getting this pushback and certainly this kind of, as the vice president said, bad-mouthing in the press for all the administration has done in his first term as well, and all the United States has done for Ukraine is just, it's unacceptable. They need to tone it down and take a hard look and sign that deal.
Yaroslav in Chicago, that escalated quickly. What was your reaction, and what is your reading of where things now stand?
Well, it's, you know, it is a stunning about to turn in American foreign policy. We now have, at the same time, President Trump saying, parroting, you know, the Russian lines, you know, saying that Ukraine had started the war, not Russia, you know, despite, you know, common sense and all available evidence. But at the same time, we also have senior U.S. officials, starting with Vice President J.D. Vance, going to Munich to the security conference and telling Europeans that basically we don't really have the same shared values with you anymore, because you have too many immigrants, because you don't allow far-right parties into government. And actually, you know, the real threat to Europe is not Putin, is not China, but how you run your own democracies. And I think we are in this historical moment where many European leaders and officials are now starting to ask themselves, you know, is this the end of the transatlantic bond? A bond that, you know, was ensured Europe's stability since the end of World War II. This is, you know, probably the most serious crisis, at least since the Suez Crisis of 1953. And if you look at this reality, if the U.S. is not there, who will defend Europe? And, you know, let's look at the numbers. You know, the Ukrainian army today that is fighting against Russia for 3 years is about 1 million men and women. It's more soldiers than France, Germany, Italy, United Kingdom, and several other European countries put together. And it's a country that really has one of the only two armies in the world that really has combat experience fighting against a near peer enemy. None of the, you know, NATO armies have had to fight this kind of war. And so when Zelensky came to Munich to say that, you know, we are the shield of Europe in this new reality, that is actually true. And that explains the urgency with which so many other European leaders are now considering this life with the broken transatlantic bond.
Janine, a broken transatlantic bond, Yaroslav makes the point. Lindsay Hilson, the chief foreign editor at Channel 4, was recently on this programme. She said this week of Zelensky's absence at the meeting. She said, history threatens to leave him behind. Is she right?
Possibly. I mean, I think that it was almost shocking to everyone to hear that Zelensky would not be in talks about his own country. And then we look back to Yalta, when Churchill, Roosevelt, and...
Stalin.
...carved up Germany into four occupied zones. I think I've had a lot of feelings going back and forth this week, but one of them is that, okay, let's say America does abandon Ukraine right now in an hour when Ukraine desperately needs America. Mm-hmm. What could happen? Could Europe step up? Could Zelensky's idea of a European army, which is a non-NATO army, could that actually work? Mm-hmm. Maybe this isn't a bad thing for Europe to begin to realign. Not always looking to America, especially Great Britain, has consistently, and we know with the Iraq War, do you remember 1 million people in Britain in the streets protesting the war? And yet Tony Blair went to war because the Americans wanted him to. This is a chance perhaps for Europe to realign and to begin to develop on their own. However, my reading from Ukraine, from my team, from our work on the ground is that yes, they do have a strong army, but that they're exhausted. This is 3 years of war now. And while Kyiv may have water and electricity, it's not Gaza, it's not the siege of Sarajevo, but Kharkiv, Kherson, the areas around the front lines in the southeast, they're desperate and they have been fighting hard for 3 years. 3 years of war is a really long time psychologically for a country to exist. So I think that what happens in the next few weeks is crucial. Another thing I wanted to point out, which was interesting, was J.D. Vance sitting down with Zelensky and then leaving the meeting, and Zelensky going one way with the narrative and Vance going the other way, and each accusing the other of lying. I mean, it has broken down the dialogue and the conversation between the two to such an extent that it's almost comic.
Yeah.
So we're at a really worrying pivot right now.
Courteous diplomacy has long disappeared this week. I think there's a caution to the Ukrainians to try to bring it back. Tom, when you look at that image in the palace in Riyadh on Monday, that's the first time we've seen senior Americans and Russians share this space in more than 3 years. The Trump-Putin meeting on the cards too. What's your take of the power dynamic in the room there?
I mean, Janine is exactly right. This has all of the hallmarks of a Yalta type carve-up. Well, at least that's the fear that is now haunting the presidential palaces and the parliaments across Europe. I was in Munich last week as well. And starting with J.D. Vance's speech and culminating in the news that the Ukrainians had apparently been presented with a fait accompli to give away their critical minerals, I genuinely think now that there is a sense in many parts, not everywhere, but in many parts of Europe, that something fundamental has changed now, and that there is going to be a step change in the way that Europeans regard their own security. And what that means in practice is very difficult to say at this stage, but there are detailed discussions taking place on matters like adjusting the fiscal rules to allow for much more defense spending, or even coming up with a big common debt project to do that. The timing of the election here obviously makes that very awkward, but even the outgoing German government has given some sign that there may be some fairly dramatic moves at the European level quite soon, and crucially before there is a German government in place. So I wouldn't be surprised to see some fairly dramatic moves on this front fairly quickly.
I want to explore that. It's a really good point, especially with regards to the Paris meeting this week and where leaders go next. But I want to raise this with you first, Mark. The idea that Trump is living in a disinformation space put forward by Volodymyr Zelensky, some suggest he's playing the so-called madman theory. Now, this has been about for a while, a negotiating tactic. According to Axios, back in 2017, he was trying to renegotiate a deal in South Korea, and he sent a chief trade negotiator, Robert Lighthizer, to tell them, Trump is a madman. You tell them the guy's crazy, he'll pull out in a minute. If you don't give concessions, he'll paddle out of the deal. Is he playing the madman theory?
I think that might have been a more valid argument for his first term. I think we're seeing on his second term, he's come in fully prepared with policy positions that were set out by a think tank. He put people in very fast, including, you know, you've got some people, Marco Rubio and so on, who had positions on Russia that have had to change under Trump's position. He definitely wants to hold center stage. He wants it to be diktats. He calls himself the king, and he wants to rule like a king. People have to owe him loyalty. People have to follow his line, and après moi le déluge. It's this seems to be the line he's taking. I think we have to make a distinction between his second term and his first term. The transatlantic thing, yeah, I mean, everyone's dead right. Obviously they're thinking about this in Brussels. They have been for some time. I mean, even before Trump got elected, there was a possibility he was going to become elected. He did get elected. There was already thought being given to it. The problem with Europe is a lot of thought is given to things and action doesn't always follow, or it's very hard to coordinate. We're going to have to see some compromises in ideals and some compromises in territory, and obviously the European Union, 27 members not fully aligned. We've got some Eastern members, Hungary, Romania, as you've mentioned, that are playing spoilers to what is generally wanted by particularly the Western members of the group.
You talk about the difference between the first term, second term. Yaroslav, I know you have mentioned the idea of the madman theory before. Do you agree with Mark's point? I mean, because another episode, another suggestion of his to and fro with Volodymyr Zelensky is that he's pretty thin-skinned about this. He's picked up on a particular issue, disinformation space with Russia, that goes back to the first term and even before that, allegations that have dogged him for a while, and he let rip. Or is he in Putin? Is Putin got his ear?
Yeah, there is both. Obviously, madman theory is in play here, but if you talk to diplomats dealing with the U.S., they are puzzled because they'll ask, where is the madness and where is the madman theory, you know, and how do we separate the two? And there's probably elements of both in this approach. It's clear that if you look at how President Trump talks about the world, you know, it's very similar to what Putin says. You know, they both share this vision of empires with spheres of influence. And the language that President Trump has used about Canada, you know, saying, well, become a 51st state, about Greenland, you know, we need to annex you because of your natural resources. It's very similar to the language, frankly, that President Putin has used against Ukraine. And so there is this shared vision to an extent there. Now, you know, Yalta was mentioned in this conversation before, but you know, let's not forget, Yalta was about dividing Europe, dividing Germany, after the Soviet armies had marched all the way to Berlin. But President Putin is not winning in Ukraine. Yes, Ukraine is suffering. Yes, you know, it's tough. But, you know, several hundred thousand Russian soldiers killed or maimed in the last year and a half of the Russian offensives. And Russia went from 19% of Ukraine to just short of 20%, gaining a couple of relatively small towns in Donbass. So in a way, what is happening now, what appears to be happening now, is President Trump is giving Putin on a silver platter everything he failed to win in battle until now.
Janine, you wanted to come in?
Yeah. I've been desperately looking for silver linings all week, you know, trying to see each policy decision, each executive order, and try to make some kind of sense of it. Mm. One thing that really did interest me is Alexander Stubbs, the Finnish president. And I think it's really important now in Europe that we begin to pay attention to the small countries, because often they have the best wisdom. Mm. And he said, perhaps instead of seeing this as a Yalta moment, we should see it as a Helsinki moment. And he was referring to the Helsinki Accords of 1975, which basically set the stage for order, for rules-based order rather than spheres of interest, which was, of course, Yalta. Mm-hmm. So I think that, again, going back to my earlier point, that maybe Europe can in some way glean something from what is happening in Washington right now and the transatlantic divide that is so gaping. And, you know, maybe it is a time when we can, as Europeans and Britain, because now Britain is part of the European package, go back to the rules-based order and international law. Because if we let that be our parameter, then we're going to have a world where we can operate. Without it, we have Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, we have dictators. So I think it was an interesting thing that he said.
Yeah, joining up allies to be a bigger voice at the table rather than the strong men speaking and shouting across at the big table. You tee up very nicely, I think, just to go through a sequence of events as to the choices facing Europe right now, because it was Paris on Monday. European leaders baffled, perhaps blindsided by the extent of blossoming relations between Presidents Trump and Putin, excluded from the Saudi talks planned for the following day, scrambled together, reassessing their own security, support for Ukraine too, and diplomacy with the US. It was the Elysee Palace to President Macron's emergency summit. Only the French weren't calling it a summit, a meeting, they said. Mixed messages around it. Seven countries invited. We were told those with the biggest defence capabilities. It didn't go down well in the bloc. Many EU leaders left out, isolated, sending diplomatic cables, trying to be part of it. Here's the official footage of the gathering ahead of the meeting. Well, the verdict of the former spokesperson for the NATO Secretary General, Oana Lungescu, said this about the so-called family photo moment. They all looked awkward, some stern, serious, others actually smiling, others hiding behind the others. It doesn't convey a sense of unity. 2 days later, a second summit or meeting or discussion, webinar, what you want to call it. Those the invited also extended to Canada, but as we mentioned before, not to Hungary or Slovakia, whose leaders are closer to Putin than their European counterparts. Tom, if a picture tells 1,000 words, what are these pictures telling you of that Paris get-together of European leaders?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look like a bundle of joy, does it? And of course, the differences amongst some member states on questions like the stationing of European peacekeeping troops in Ukraine, for example, were on full display there. That's something that President Macron has been calling for a while. By contrast, not only with Chancellor Olaf Scholz, but pretty much every party in the German mainstream is extremely sceptical about that prospect, especially if it doesn't involve some kind of meaningful support from the Americans, which might be quite hard to come by these days. All of that said, I wouldn't be too hasty in writing this off. This meeting was convened with literally 24 hours notice in the kind of wake of the Munich Security Conference. It's happening before a German election. You're not going to get any meaningful announcements at the end of a German election campaign. And, you know, I think that European leaders now, as I said before, are really having their eyes open to the new order that confronts them with this fresh American administration. That's going to take time to translate into kind of meaningful policy change and announcement. You'll probably see a lot more of these meetings. I think there may be an emergency European Council scheduled for March at some point. Of course, we've got Macron and Starmer both going on separate trips to see Trump the next week. So I think watch this space rather than be too downhearted by the divisions that you saw in Paris on Monday.
Well, you will know, and you and I both from time in Brussels, that these things come up and disappear. They have over decades, the idea of a European army, the idea of a security. As I understand it, this is something separate to NATO, that there would be something that could be concurrent, that, as you talked about, President Macron and also Keir Starmer talked about, and also that they might go to Donald Trump next week, is reported in the UK press, with an idea of sending 30,000 troops at some stage, not as peacekeepers, but a reassurance force is a term they're using. Tom, you've seen these terms mentioned time and time again, but effectively you're saying that ultimately it comes down to Trump as the catalyst to seeing change.
No one knows what the American policy is. Mm. We've got several people who are working on this, from the National Security Advisor to the Secretary of State to kind of specific envoys, some of whom appear to have a mandate from Trump, some of whom don't, all of whom are contradicting one another. So all we really have to go on are short readouts from meetings, vibes that come from social media posts from the president or from the vice president, and no real policy to speak of at all. I thought one of the most interesting things about the speech that President Zelensky gave in Munich is that he appears to have become so frustrated with the inability of Europeans to respond to the fresh set of circumstances that they find themselves in, that he was, as it were, intervening in European debates. He called for a European army. This is not something that's going to happen anytime soon, probably ever. But there was a sense of urgency in the tone that he addressed his European audience with that I think tells you something about the way in which the Ukrainians understand that the world has now fundamentally changed. He understands that, for obvious reasons, with a degree of urgency that hasn't yet settled in across Europe, and I think he was trying to encourage that. I think the question of peacekeeping troops, it's certainly premature. It might even be a little bit of a distraction. We have to see what the American position is going to be, but I think certainly from a German perspective and maybe some other European countries, this is going to be more about supplying Ukraine with fresh arms, training its troops, providing a lot more money, perhaps changing its own internal rules to allow that to happen. There will be more discussions on Ukraine's path towards EU membership. Mm. They might be the things that we'll be paying more attention to in the weeks and months ahead rather than a substantial deployment of European troops to Ukraine itself.
Very interesting, Tom. Just to bring you in, Mark, because you've spent a number of years, 5 years, I think, in Brussels as well. A case in point right now, Europe at odds with the US. We've seen the latest round of sanctions against Russia from the EU, also having this sort of blossoming relations over in the Atlantic with Washington.
Well, of course, Europe's toolbox is very different to America's. Yes, it's sanctions, it's financial, it's the American funds that are held in SWIFT that the Americans used to want to be grabbed, seized, which would weaken the euro, and which probably would play into the wishes of some on the right in America. What I find interesting about the meetings that went on headed by Macron is I think there's a lot of niceties that are being stripped away. It's a galvanizing moment. There isn't time to do the usual diplomatic, political window dressing, if you like, or the niceties are there. They have to think one or two steps down the path. Now, if the security guarantees that people have relied on for decades from America are no longer there, what do we have? You know, what needs to be brought together? That's the sort of table that I would be seeing as an initial step for discussion. I don't think that it's, you know, I don't think it's there's anything concrete or anything there, but I can see that as the beginning of a tunnel of a process that hopefully more many in Brussels, particularly a NATO chief there, will hope won't be necessary. But if they're not doing this sort of preparation work now, that would show a big political shortfall, a lack of foresight. So to think about, security architecture with a very changed America in it or out of it, I think this is what we're starting to see.
Ginny, when it comes to actually somebody in Europe standing up and delivering a response to Donald Trump, we've seen it in kind of murmured tones and what, you know, Emmanuel Macron has said he's going to say to him. He's going to point out we have to be tough on Putin. If we're not, it gives a bad signal or a weak signal to China. And yet there's barely a mention publicly by leaders about this deal, which many criticise for being taking the best of the minerals of Ukraine and not offering much in return. That's one perspective of it. What's your take on who's standing up right now and how they're calibrating their response to Trump?
I don't think we have much choice, first of all, but like between Germany and France, it's Macron. I think Macron's foreign policy is I think he's, I admire his foreign policy. I think he's been good on the Middle East. I think he's been good on Ukraine. Until now, he's managed America. Germany has been appalling on Palestine and Gaza and the entire situation. They've been good on Ukraine, but not good on the Middle East. Keir Starmer, I think it's untested. I find him weak. I don't think he's, again, he's good on Ukraine, not good on Middle East. So I think it's got to be Macron. But I want to get back to Tom's point about peacekeeping troops, because I think this is really...
Or reassurance troops, possibly.
Reassurance troops. But I just want to go back to 35 years ago to the Bosnian War, right? Which I feel I'm getting a lot of deja vu with what's happening now, because if you remember, it was always the Europeans saying it's an American problem. And the Americans, Clinton administration saying, this is Europe's issue. It's on your doorstep. And while they dithered, a genocide happened, and 8,000 Muslim men and boys were murdered at Srebrenica. And that was basically the stalled, you know, the stalled diplomacy. And there were peacekeeping troops all along, but they were muzzled. They were completely muzzled. They couldn't fire unless they were fired upon. And I think that's when we began to look at the failings of the UN, DPKO in particular, the Department of Peacekeeping. But I do think, I mean, I'm intrigued by this idea of a European army, although I think most NATO member states would not, it would not fly with them. I think they want to stick within the realms and the protocol of what NATO does.
That is very interesting. That takes us to one particular, you mentioned the Germans, it takes us to one particular European country where, well, the TV election debates have been taking place ahead of this weekend's vote. Unprecedented too. The public broadcasters adapting to increasing political fragmentation, continuing rise of the AfD, held two four-way debates on Sunday and Monday, and then an eight-way debate on Thursday. Well, the biggest issues for voters are a world away from the last elections. The two top issues then were addressing COVID restrictions, the climate, now migration, integration, the economy dominate. The polls haven't shifted much since the collapse of the coalition, led by Olaf Scholz, the Socialist Democrat, back in November. All major predictions suggest it will be this man in the middle here that's going to be a new chancellor, the 69-year-old conservative leader, Friedrich Merz. Not as majority winner, but through coalition building. And he appears to know that too. Here he is a few weeks ago, speaking at Davos, the World Economic Forum.
We are leading the opinion polls, far ahead of all the others, and we are convinced that we will win. And that we will then form a new government in Germany. And this is extremely necessary for our country to have a new government and new economic policy and so on. So you are seeing me very, very happy and very, very optimistic.
Tom, you recently sat down with Friedrich Merz for an hour. Tell us about that and how he came across.
Yeah, I mean, we met him a couple of weeks ago. And at the time, it was an extremely fraught, the most fraught moment of the campaign, because he had just... taken a huge gamble by pushing a couple of anti-immigration, anti-irregular immigration motions through the Bundestag with the support of the far-right AfD. And for many people in Germany, this was a violation of a taboo that has stood since the foundation of the Federal Republic after the Second World War. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets in protest. The parties on the left accused Friedrich Merz of giving a platform to the far right. He, of course, denied that. So this was the kind of the backdrop to our interview with him. He was confident, just as he was in the clip you just showed from Davos. He has a very sort of stark line. It's fairly sort of pessimistic in a way. He likes to say that if the next government doesn't get a handle on two particular problems, fixing irregular migration and improving the economy, which has been in recession for 2 years, then the AfD might win the next election in 2029. So that's where we are now. It feels very, very different from 2021. As you mentioned, I covered that election. That was the election that saw the end of Angela Merkel. And there was a feeling at that time of optimism. Let's bring together a new government that can deal with all of the things that Merkel neglected on digitalization, on improving the citizenship law, all sorts of things. That didn't work out at all. And now, in every regard, really, all of the pillars of stability in Germany that secured its prosperity and its security since the end of the Second World War, and particularly since 1989, are crumbling. And that's why the mood this time has been far, far bleaker.
So it's crumbling. He also, Tom, talks about, I think he spoke to you and talked about how the business model of Germany is broken. I think his view of Germany's place in the world, he's spoken about ramping up strategic capacity from being a, quote, sleeping middle power to a leading middle power, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think a crucial thing for a Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, will be to restore Germany's place at the heart of European decision-making. Germany has been pretty absent in Brussels under Olaf Scholz after the long period under Angela Merkel. And ask Merz about almost any policy, and you will find that it goes through Europe, and in particular through two countries, France, where you're sitting, and Poland. He wants to restore the strength of these bilateral relationships, and he wants to restore a German voice at the heart of Europe. And one thing that's very interesting is that for most of the campaign, with the very big exception of this migration gambit that I mentioned, Merz has been pretty cautious. He talks a good game on the economy, but his remedies aren't particularly exciting. It's sort of deregulation and tax cuts. Similarly, on foreign policy and security, extremely cautious about coming up with any proposals that would represent a radical shift from Germany's position under Olaf Scholz. That has, in literally the last couple of days, I think he's confident now of victory. That started to change. He spoke this morning of Europe needing to understand that the Article 5, NATO Article 5 guarantee may be slipping away under the Trump administration. Wow. Europe needs to think about nuclear sharing, maybe even extending France's nuclear umbrella to Germany and the rest of Europe. These are very radical ideas to be introducing at the very end of an election campaign. And that's why I'm going to be watching him very closely after he presumably wins his victory on Sunday to see if this is a conversation that he wants to lead now in Germany, even before he forms a government, which, of course, will take probably a couple of months or more.
Wow. So it could be that the Grand Coalition Redux is a possibility with the Social Democrats back in. Jaroslav, it's very interesting listening to Tom, because a couple of things that he raised. First of all, I should say Olaf Scholz is saying that he shouldn't be written off. He says it's about the ordinary people. Tom, I hope my German's right. He says, die ganz normalen Leute. He used that in a speech 17 times recently. But Jaroslav in Chicago, Germany's timings is hardly ideal for its election, is it? You know, with US in full operation, days of thunder mode, is Germany's diplomatic weakness being noticed in the White House?
Oh, yes, for sure, for sure. And, you know, this is not no accident that this dramatic reversal in American foreign policy is happening when Europe is, you know, in this strange situation where France has a minority government. You know, Emmanuel Macron is trying to be the judge diplomatically, but, you know, his party does not have a majority in parliament. And the government is very fragile, it fell once. And Germany is going to be paralyzed by this coalition politics for the next several months. So President Trump is seizing the initiative.
Very briefly, we've got on your point, Jaroslav, I want to bring in both Janine and Mark. Just on a legacy point, if, let's see what happens to Olaf Scholz. I heard one quote of him by a senior fellow at RUSI say, Olaf Scholz managed over 4 years a singular feat of getting on with nobody in Europe and beyond, showing a limp face of Germany and around the world. Ouch. Is he right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look at Germany's economy. Look at their place in the world, their place in foreign policy and diplomacy, their COVID restrictions, their relationship with Russia. I mean, we could go on. It is a painful thing that that will be his legacy, but unfortunately, he didn't make his mark in his term.
Mark.
Very hard to follow Angela Merkel as a show. I mean, despite her failings, she was a very strong figure. He seemed to play it. The criticism was, a lot of people said, that he seemed to play it like he remained the mayor of Hamburg.
The hamburger to the end. Well, let's see what happens. Thank you, all of you. In a week that there's been division, constant theme here, a moment of connection to end on with a nod to German electronica. Thank you first, Tom Nuttall in Berlin from The Economist, Yaroslav Trofimov from The Wall Street Journal, Jenny DiGiovanni, seasoned war correspondent, author and head of the Reckoning Project, and Mark Burley at AFP as well. So this, to end on, is a nod to German electronica, something of a Kraftwerk gig about it. EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen taking centre stage earlier this month, alongside Baltic leaders in style of a Eurovision supergroup. They perform the official rerouting of the Baltic power supply from Russia to the EU system. Here is their moment of connection.
Please activate the connection.
Since 2006, in French, English, Arabic and Spanish, the world's most influential figures trust us with exclusive interviews. Global leaders sharing their visions for the future. Artists and creators spark inspiration. Thought leaders and innovators shape what's next. The biggest names are on France 24.
Liberté, égalité, actualité.